I'm Amir Alwani from PotentNews.com. Today I'm very honored to be speaking with Jan Irvin from GnosticMedia.com and TriviumEducation.com. Our guest today has an understanding of the many ways we're being poisoned, not just from our food and water and air, but more significantly, he sheds light on how our minds are poisoned, and he empowers us with time-tested observations that enable us to bypass this relentless programming. This entails a rediscovery of what we actually are, specifically with respect to what learning is, how learning actually functions, and how we can arrive at more certainty in our decision-making so that we can maintain an accurate view of the world around us, an accurate view of our personal responsibility, and an accurate view of the genuine freedom that entails or that results when we are in our optimal state of being and awareness. He knows about the prison we live in, but he also seems to know a lot about how to do the great work required to get us out of this prison. Welcome to the show, Jan Irvin.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, so I wasn't sure exactly where to begin, but I think I'll just play it by ear here. First, can you define the word philosophy? And just because I often hear people say, well, that's just a philosophical argument, or that's just, you know, you're philosophizing too much. But what does the word actually mean?
Hey, well, the word actually, philo means love, and sophy is wisdom, so it's the love of wisdom. To me, it would mean simply, and of course, there's all of the historical philosophy, but it's the love of learning and of understanding, learning the things around you, understanding what they are, and being able to express that information to others.
Excellent. And what is epistemology?
Well, epistemology is really the study of how we know things. You're getting into definitions here. I'm not prepared with a dictionary in front of me. I guess I could be. Let me open up the Oxford English Dictionary here, and then we can just go right from the Oxford English Dictionary.
Sure. Well, you know what they say is good to define your terms. These are just a few things to get out of the way.
And Oxford defines it very simply here. They just say the theory or science of the method or grounds of knowledge.
The theory or science of the method or grounds of knowledge.
Right. And how we define knowledge in terms of the trivium would be essentially, first off, the nouns around you and their attributes. So like, everything around you is a noun. Your computer, your chair, your headphones on your head, your shirt, the table you're sitting in front of, everything around you is described a noun. And then each of these have attributes. They're brown, or, you know, if it's a moving object, if you've got a goldfish there, it's swimming, etc., you know. And so these are things that we can see and understand in nature. We don't see, like, two nouns occupying the same place at the same time. This is a contradiction. And so these nouns are essentially our knowledge, and they're composed of who, what, where, and when. And so these are all things that we use to know the world around us. And so this is essentially a foundational level of understanding knowledge. So, for instance, if you were to look out the window, everything you see there is a noun. You have the trees, you get the street, whatever. You've got telephone poles, birds, animals, whatever it may be. You don't see bird, dog, tree, sun, things like this. You know, it's these are obvious contradictions. And so these are things that when we look out into nature, we can simply understand. And then when we see these contradictions, we know, you know, that, well, hey, you know, there's an error here somewhere. You know, if somebody claims that there's a pink flamingo sitting on the table with me, or maybe there's, you know, the elephant in the room, just to use a funny analogy. But, you know, somebody says there's a pink flamingo on the desk here in front of me, and right here in the video, we can see that that's not true. And in the commons, in common sense reality, we can all verify that there's no pink flamingo here. And, you know, if I tell you, well, you know, there is a pink flamingo here, but you're not being spiritual enough, you just don't see it. Well, you know, this is, this is basically... You know, I'm pulling your leg, and this is how trickery basically works. The onus of proof falls on me to support any claim with, things that we can verify in the commons that you and I can see and taste and touch and smell and hear. And so, you know, these things around us, these nouns, essentially become knowledge, and then there's how we know those things. What is the philosophy of knowledge itself.
Okay, so in that system, then one thing I just like to add that I recently heard on this Unplugged Mom podcast is I just want to echo something she said, which is that the trivium itself is more, it's not so much a prescription as much as it is a discovery or like an observation of something that's naturally there.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's basically all the trivium is it's a way to step back and look at things from 5 feet, 10 feet, 1,000 feet, 10,000 feet, whatever. Look at all of the data points, and then constantly review them. And you know, it's not. It's basically it's just a system to constantly recheck our information and make sure that any new information that comes in, we're not dismissing it with some fallacy, killing the messenger, or, you know, you're a jerk or you're an idiot, so we're not going to listen to what you have to say. It just says, oh, you know, wait, if I use that attack on this person and dismiss them just out of hand, what information am I missing? And, and so then what happens is then we end up listening to the person or reading the information or the book or listening to the full presentation. And even if it's a 95% lie or 95% BS, there might be 5% of the information in there that's true and valid to us that we can take and use and go, aha, you know. So it becomes just a way that we're checking our thoughts, looking for fallacies in our thoughts for the information coming in via the five senses. Did we really verify the information? Are we passing on a mental virus? Are there contradictions in this information? Have I gone back and looked at all of the nouns? You know, let me put this another way. Let's say if you were to take a car and you take it out on the driveway, out in front of your house or wherever, and you take the whole car apart, every single piece, and you lay every single piece out on the driveway and everything, and you can see every single piece and you can identify them. Well, that would be essentially knowledge. Now you've identified every single piece that the car is made out of. You have an understanding of it. You can even go further down into it, like the spark plug. What's the history of the spark plug? Who invented it? And you can get a technical understanding of the spark plug, or even the fuel injection system or whatever it may be, and you can get an in-depth understanding of each of these things. And so all of these parts are laying out, and when you I have them all identified, that is your knowledge. That is all of those nouns, you know, the bolts, the screws, the whatever it may be there. It's all of those nouns, the doors, the wheels, the rims, everything. And so when you take all of those parts and you begin to put them together, let's say if you have a contradiction, you know, you're trying to put the engine in the trunk instead of under the hood, you know, and it, you know, things just aren't working right, and it's, you know, nothing's hooking up, and you're like, man, there's all these contradictions, I just don't get it, something's not right here. So then you go back and you look at everything. Ah, look at that, you know, I'm trying to put this engine on the wrong part of the car. You get the engine under the hood and you begin to hook it up and everything's connecting, and then you go inside and you put the key in the ignition and you turn it and the thing starts. Uh-huh. Now the thing is running, all of the contradictions removed, everything works. Now let's say if you wanted to write a manual, just like a Chilton's manual that mechanics use for putting cars, taking cars apart and putting them back together. Then you could say you could write a Chilton's manual, or you could give a lecture on the steps that you took to take the car apart, you know, all of the parts and how you put it back together again. And that would be the essentially the how or the wisdom. So the first part is all of the who, what, where, and when, all of the parts in the driveway. That's the knowledge. And then the second part, getting all of those parts together, that would be the understanding. And then the final part would be the wisdom. You can take systematic knowledge and understanding and put it together and then be able to explain it to other people in a systematic way that they could go and then repeat that themselves. And if you do it properly, you empower them with the ability to you know, understand the foundations and not just have to appeal to a teacher each time they you know, wanted to take apart another car or whatever. They would understand the basic foundational premises. And if you walked them through the same process of the who, what, where, when, why, and how, they would essentially be able to accomplish the same things.
Now, is it true that this used to be taught to children in grade 8?
Well, in the United States, in the single-room schoolhouses, probably up in Canada as well, it was very common in many areas for the schoolrooms to use the trivium as a method of education. In fact, that's often considered what may have sparked the American Revolution and the industrial era. And so at the same time, when we see the compulsory education system coming in and John Dewey and all of these coming in and taking over education, we see the subversion of the single room schoolhouses. We see getting rid of critical thinking, especially, you know, you don't want to teach little kids the fallacies. Otherwise, whoa. You know, in fact, there was a newspaper article a couple of years ago out of Texas about how it'd be bad to teach children logic and critical thinking because then they might see the lies in society and think badly on society, you know. And, you know, and it's just like, yeah, that's some backwards logic there, to say the least.
It's like some Santa Claus thing.
And yeah, and even today they teach that if you use logic, it's considered abusive. You know, everybody should just think with their emotions. So then, you know, everybody appeals to emotion, which is actually a logical fallacy, where instead of, you know, putting your emotions in a jar and then looking at the facts, and then once you have all of the facts and you've dealt with everything, then you can let the emotions back out of the jar. You know, it's not to necessarily deny that the emotions exist or that they're important. It's just that, you know, and many times, you know, we need to set our biases and emotions aside and be able to deal with the facts. And, you know, a lot of people based on emotions, they'll get caught up, for instance, in years of or a lifetime of mystical or false beliefs because they don't spend 10 minutes or a couple of days or a couple of weeks to verify their beliefs. And so, you know, they say, well, I don't have the time to do the research to check that. But then they'll go on for an entire lifetime believing false beliefs. And then we have this added layer, it's really popular lately, of teaching people in colleges and universities that there is no truth, you can't know anything, you know, might as well not even look, might as well not even try to know anything, and appeal to our authority, you know, this smokescreen type of scenarios. So getting people to understand that they can trust their own five senses and begin to go out and look for information and trust themselves and rebuild their own self-esteem is really big for people, because they're so wrapped up in the mystical. You know, it's like this guy Mick Goswami, the quantum physics guy from Oregon, the professor up there. You know, he says that no two quantum physicists understand what it is, and none of them are on the same page about it. Well, you know, whenever there's contradictions, you realize that there is an error or a lie. And so that should alert you that you have to go down further into the foundation or question your premises. And so what these people do, instead of realizing that a contradiction is a lie, and what they do is essentially they create mathematical formulas to work around the contradictions and lies, you know. And so, quantum physics is a really interesting thing. I did a couple of interviews with David Harriman on this, but he's got a really excellent lecture series called The Philosophic Corruption of Physics, where he really goes into the depth and history of this whole issue and the problem. And I really recommend people study that. And instead of just, you know, writing me about all of his haters and things like that, you know, I talked about the Trivium a minute ago and reading and study things before you judge them, knowing all of the information that's there, like all of the parts laid out in the driveway. So what that implies is essentially, you know, go out and study all of this guy's work, understand what it is, take it in, and then decide it before you write me hate mail. Because, you know, you're caught into quantum physics or New Age mysticism.
Definitely. People, you know, it's like 2 + 2 = 4. It doesn't matter if a monster says that to you. It doesn't matter if a frog says that to you. It doesn't matter if, you know.
Well, if a frog says it to you, you might want to question what's going on there.
Yeah.
But the CIA's probably gotten hold of you.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you get what I'm saying there. So yeah. Now, about the fallacies, maybe I'll just raise one example of what is a fallacy here. Apparently this, and I want to relate it to a Terrence McKenna quote that I put in one of a song that I worked on with Q249 a couple years ago. So this René Descartes, 17th century French philosopher, said, "I think, therefore I am." And when I look at this, it's like he started with I, and he's overlooking this. And it's what fallacy is occurring there when there's a circular argument whereby the conclusion is included in the premise?
Well, I suppose that would be the fallacy of begging the question, or circular argument, essentially. But, you know, in fact, I just mentioned David Harriman. He goes in and covers the problems of René Descartes' argument in his book, I think, The Logical Leap, or it could have been in his lecture series. But there's a lot of information in there. I'm not, you know, it's like I go in and out of studying philosophy. I like to mostly study MKUltra and things like that. That's my primary area of expertise.
And that's sort of how I wanted to segue into that, because the Terrence McKenna quote is that we put in that song is, culture plays a game of simplification. If you can make people think alike, they will buy alike, they will worship alike, and if politics demand it, they will kill alike. So the uniformitarian agenda of culture is not an agenda friendly to you or to me or to any other individual. Now, at the time, I thought, you know, that made sense. Now I'm looking at it, and it's like the same sort of thing, putting the, you're already stating that culture plays a game of simplification at the start.
A culture is basically what, it's the glue that keeps a group of people together and keeps them moving forward and keeps things working, and so basically, you had in the psychedelic culture, you had a constant barrage of attacks on culture, on the family, on you know, anything that that would make things fall. Anything that would keep things together if say the central government collapsed. And so what you do is you have this promotion of single mothers and feminism and you know, reliance on the government and the state and socialist ideas, etc., so that people are always reliant upon that. But hidden within the psychedelic 60s agenda is really just a attack on the family and the culture, and they constantly try to portray the culture or the society as bad. And, you know, our cultures are what our traditions are what keep us essentially moving forward. And, you know, so you have to attack that. You have to attack the family unit if you want to build a strong communist or socialist type system.
Yeah, I mean, like, he was saying stuff like, okay, the culture, you didn't ask to be born into this culture, yet it expects you to pass on all these things to your children. And I'm thinking, like, I didn't ask to be to have to work within the certain parameters of the sun, for example. I mean, the sun was there before I was born. Do I get mad at the sun for
right Well, you know, and, you know, essentially it's like, yeah, it's all chance, you know, where we're born and all of this stuff. But each culture has certain things that have lasted for thousands of years that have gotten us here today. And, you know, we wouldn't be here today basically without it. And, you know, so, and even to some point religion, although religion is definitely a form of mind control, but, you know, there's definitely attack on the so-called nuclear family, but even more so on the extended family, where in the Middle East, in South America and Mexico, and a lot of parts of Europe, you have these large extended families where aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, grandmothers, etc., all grandfathers, all live in the same location with maybe several houses on the same property or whatever, and they're all working the same land. You know, and the government system could fall apart around them. They, you know, often wouldn't even care because they've got, you know, their cattle, their pigs, their chickens, their food and everything right there that they can immediately go to and that they've always used throughout time. And the rest is outside of that. So if you can break that internal thing apart, then you can create a reliance, you know, you further break it down, like in the United States, probably in Canada as well, during the 1950s, 1940s, they made it impossible for extended families to get home loans. So it had to be nuclear families, mother, father, you know, son, daughter, that type of thing. And that was it. If you were this large family, they wouldn't give you the loan. So this was essentially intentionally to break apart the core family unit. And then, you know, then you can get the kids in the public schools, and then they're no longer being homeschooled and taught the trivium. They're no longer being taught direct survival skills and things like that. And you get the mothers and fathers in the factories at the same time, because now you've got them, you know, they've got to come up with money to pay taxes. And then what you do is you sell women's liberation. You market it to them so that the other half of the population that wasn't taxed can then be taxed. And so this was all, you know, and they think it was all about women's liberation, but it was actually about getting the other half of the population that they couldn't tax under the boot of the government and the taxation system. So then this further breaks apart the family unit. You know, now they, you know, the government is the babysitter while the parents are off in the factories, and you know, so it's a win-win for them, and it's a lose-lose for everybody else.
All right, so I guess if one wanted to add on something to correct McKenna's statement, I'll just read it again really quickly. Culture plays a game of simplification. If you can make people think alike, they will buy alike, they will worship alike, and if politics demands it, they will kill alike. So the uniformitarian agenda of culture is not an agenda friendly to you or to me or to any other individual. You could add on to that, unless culture has understanding of natural law and truly sees the value of practicing the non-aggression principle.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Essentially, you know, it's like Peter McWilliams said, my freedom ends where your nose begin. And if you educate people and uplift them, right, you know, see, McKenna and these people, they always love to promote ignorance and mysticism. And that always, you know, that should always raise a big question mark in people's minds when you hear somebody promoting non-answers or things that you can't go and verify. And you know, it's like, yeah, you know, we're born into a culture. Yeah, politicians can drag us into war, you know, but, you know, typically family units and extended family units don't like to get into war. Typically, they try to avoid war at all costs and they'll only resort to it as a final resort. It's, you know, it's governments with central banks that and politicians that drag you, you know, and give you orders to go kill somebody somewhere that you've never met before, that you have no affiliation to, for their political wars. And then what they do is they, you know, promote statism and the attacks on them. They try to get the public to believe that they are actually being attacked as well, when it really has nothing to do with the public. It's simply a war between elite factions. But then, you know, we go and, you know, we get caught up into their, you know, rah-rah patriotism. And then they, you know, send all the boys into ditches to kill themselves, which is, you know, another way to break apart the family unit. And not only that, it's eugenics as well. You give a bunch of boys guns and you throw them in ditches and you tell them to kill each other off, and then you declare some kind of victory. And of course, the only people that lose are the the poor people generally. And so this is just their way of, you know, committing eugenics against the masses that they constantly keep dumbed down. It's like you raise these black kids in the hood, you pump all these drugs and guns and have all of this crime in these areas. You keep drugs illegal so that the crime manifests, and then you create gangs around that, and then these people spend their lives in jail, and then you offer them jobs in the military, you know, so they go from jail with a regimented being in a cage system, taking orders, all of this stuff, with all of the violence and everything already incorporated into their lives. And then you put them out in the field somewhere where their lives are regimented, where they're, you know, without the bars, essentially. That's the only thing that's different, but their wake and sleep is totally regimented. Everything is regimented. And then they're told to go out and kill people for somebody else this time instead.
Yeah. Now, about this attack on the family and the culture, like, even in Libya, I'm not a fan of Gaddafi. Sure, he was a dictator. But, you know, I heard that when he was in power there near the end, or maybe longer, if you got married to a person, you received, like, thousands of dollars from him.
Yeah, and I'm not saying... I think he gave every new couple $50,000, and he also paid, if you bought a new car, he paid for half of it. Every new couple was given $50,000 to buy a new house, though. And like I said, the government paid half of the, you know, any new car that you wanted, etc. Now, you know, some would say, where is the government getting that money from? Are they taxing it from the people? It appears that most of the money that Gaddafi was doing this with was likely money from the oil and things like that. But you know, the reason why he was assassinated by the U.S. essentially was because you know, he was the president of United Africa, and he was bringing in a gold diner system that would have forced oil sales back on gold. And when there's a video of Gaddafi driving all around Tripoli, hanging out of his car, just running around, you know, and shaking hands with people, etc. And you don't see any other leader anywhere doing this. And, you know, people were just, you know, storming out of buildings all over the city, coming out to meet him. So it's like, really, was he a tyrant, or is it more so that the Western government paints him as such? You know, and interestingly, I don't think Libyan banks charged interest, etc., which, of course, is Islamic law. And so there's always that factor. And then one of the first things that was done when he was thrown out was they brought in a central bank that's had usury and all of this stuff that's against Islamic law. So, you know, there are all of these things. You know, he promoted family cohesion and a new home and, you know, education and all of these things. And he's certainly portrayed to us as a tyrant. But then again, we've got the most... warring, aggressive society on Earth. So who are we to say?
Well, and we can also, some might juxtapose this situation to with child protective services and whatnot. And I didn't have the best childhood. I wasn't raped or anything. But when I was growing up and there was some violence, I knew in my heart, I did not think that if I called the police or if I got, you know, aligned with this mafia here like this, that they would help me. And we see a lot of cases with CPS that they don't, they abuse their power often. They'll just take people.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And, well, you know, that's what centralized authority does. You give somebody a minimum wage job that's got a high school or two-year education, and you give them a polyester $15 jacket with some letters on the back and a little badge, and you tell them that they, you know, have authority over other people. And these are people that are essentially have never had authority, and so then they, you know, go around and... You know, and they don't have critical thinking. They don't understand the socialist system there, and their paycheck requires them. You know, it's based on theft of money from other people around them to begin with, and then they go out and impose force on others. And without the polyester jacket or the Halloween costume, whichever the case may be, you know, they really have no other authority over anyone. You know, these people normally wouldn't go out and commit acts of aggression, et cetera, on other people just because they have a polyester jacket on. Right, you know. And so you tell them that they have backing from this mystical figure called government. I mean, point to government. Where is government? Government is really a religion. There are buildings, but that's not government. Essentially, government is just a bunch of people who put on costumes and then go out and act the ritual of government. And so government is the ultimate religion. And when people begin to wake up that government is just a religion and that they're all wearing Halloween costumes and it's essentially just a method for peacocking and to commit violence against others, then often they wake up and they stop doing it, you know. But, you know, what other time would you, you know, go over and steal from your neighbor to give it to yourself or to someone else except under the authority of so-called government? And, you know, so... You know, it's just this whole same repetitive status theme. Anyway.
Well, definitely this anarchy thing seems to be catching on, though, with a lot of people. Over the past few months, I've been watching more videos on it, seeing Larkin Rose's videos, and I was inspired to put a anarchy section at the top of the potentnews.com website under the menu.
You know, it's really, you know, even anarchy has been used by the elites. It's probably better to consider it a voluntarist type society. You know, it's like Larkin explains, you know, when you pull up to a stop sign, that's really anarchy because people have really been programmed that anarchy is this bad thing. But a grocery store, you know, when you go to a grocery store, you buy from the grocery store, the employees there, that is actually a system of anarchy. Which is basically everybody is there by free will. Anyone can leave, come or leave as they choose, the employees, the customers, etc. So that's a system of anarchy. But they think that, you know, all of society would break down if we didn't have a centralized government there to tell us what to do with every second of our lives. But, you know, when we, you know, you pull up to a stop sign and, you know, I mean... One time out of several thousand, you might have an accident, and you know, okay, but you know, all the roads don't just suddenly stop because you know there's a stop sign there, right? I mean, the whole idea that society would break down because we're in anarchy is ridiculous. I mean, you know, when you think about, oh well, who would do the roads? Well, who does the roads already? People, you know. So rather than having someone come with a gun and tell you that you have to give them money by force every year or they're going to lock you up, you know, essentially, you know, you look out on your road and, you know, and when you're not having a third to half of your money stolen every year by the government to send to Israel or wherever, then you suddenly have a lot more money to do other more productive things like make more money. You know, it's like often money goes into making more money and things like that. And you look outside one day and you say, you know, I wouldn't mind at all chipping in for a new community center downtown, or, you know, my neighbors just came by and they're all putting in a pool. You know, everybody just throws in what they can for repaving the road, etc. And, you know, but it can function. And what's interesting is, you know, like in the Bitcoin community, you really... see this because the Bitcoin community is a totally voluntary opt-in, your choice society. And so because it's outside of a centralized government and it's a free choice community, what you see is a lot of community reinvestment. You know, wells being built for schools in Africa, you know, people sending people to school, the Dogecoin group, they sent the Jamaicans to the Olympics, you know, so you have all of this community stuff already starting to happen. And what happens is it's real community funding, because like in the Bitcoin community, when you send somebody the money and they make their address public, you can actually watch where they're sending the money to, so the people can actually see it. Whereas like these large nonprofit organizations today are renowned for you know, sucking money out of the public, and then maybe 1-3% actually gets to the destination that it's supposed to, and the rest is eaten up by, you know, bureaucratic and corporate, you know, red tape and jets and mansions. And so, you know, it creates a totally different type of community where instead of leeches and things like that, you get a direct feedback loop. And in a system of anarchy, you know, it's like in a nonprofit organization, if they're doing bad, you know, it gets around the community really fast. It's like eBay. You know, somebody screws a few people enough times on eBay, eBay is a total anarchy. I mean, it doesn't get any more, you know, I mean, except for, you know, eBay, the central company, the way that it works is essentially anarchy, and you have a system of stars and everything. When people screw other people over, they get, like, you know, their star ratings start going down, and pretty soon eBay locks them out from doing business. But the more negative reviews they get, the fewer people do business with them, and pretty soon they're out. Or they do well, they have all five-star reviews, they don't screw up, and they and the opposite happens. They're you know, they're promoted. And so, you know, this is how it should be. We don't need, you know, all of these, you know, governments going around to quote-unquote regulate us while they're causing most of the problems. It's like, you know, the government and all these people saying, you know, Bitcoin needs to be regulated. Bitcoin is regulated by the program itself. There, you know, it's open source. Anybody can go in and they can read the program. Just because you have a company like Mt. Gox who robs a bunch of people, that has absolutely nothing to do with Bitcoin whatsoever. And so all these people screech, you know, Bitcoin needs to be regulated or banned or all of this stuff. And, you know, so it's like, you know, here's the current money system. It's brought in, you know, it's centralized. It still has all of this corruption. You still have the Bernie Madoffs. You still have the bank scandals and the, you know, Goldman Sachs and all of this stuff. You still have all of this corruption. You still have all of these regulators. And yet it's only gotten worse, period. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin, yeah, a company can be corrupt, but there's a way to protect, you know, people can store it in, you know, private paper wallets and things like that. But if you're leaving your money on somebody else's website where they have the control of it, over it anywhere, that's always the risk that you take, is that it could be stolen. You know, so, you know, it essentially, you know, this causes a whole, the Bitcoin, it decentralizes everything, and it puts the power of everything back towards the people. And, you know, it sort of feeds into overall this you know, community support. And when you don't have, you know, government there creating money out of thin air and constantly devaluing the money, making it inflationary, you don't have people going around stealing your money, wearing funny costumes and things like that, then what happens is the society becomes much more productive on its own. But they don't, you know, want people to realize that the whole facade of government is just normal people that already do this stuff, that just put on funny costumes and worship a god called government.
And it's interesting that you talk about the Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies leveling the playing field and the economy and getting around a lot of annoying things that used to be present. I'd like to add, like, even before sort of this took off, we sort of saw the leveling of the playing field in the media technology, so that it became a lot easier for people like me to do what we're doing.
Sure.
And at the same time, there was people weren't trusting the governments anymore, so their emotional walls were not as resisting the information that people like me would want to put out. So now I think if people like me get a better understanding of what Bitcoin is, to the point that I can feel comfortable putting a Bitcoin donation button on my website, then I can, you know, be that much more motivated to continue to do this work that,
yeah,
I want to do.
Yeah, and there's a whole lot of disinformation out there about Bitcoin too. People think that it's centralized, that the government can just come in and shut it down at any time. Or, you know, people don't understand that it's open source and that thousands of programmers all over the world every day. I know somebody who just emailed me the other day. He said, I listen to your shows on Bitcoin. I know C++. I went in and I looked at the code and he's like, yeah, I'm all for this, you know. And it's like, yeah, you can go in. If you don't understand Bitcoin, Go get a C++ book, read it, go into Bitcoin, read the code, and understand it for yourself. It's right there for anybody to go in and look at. You know, and they say, well, you know, what if the government shuts it down? Well, it's decentralized. There's no central server for anybody to shut down. So any person who installs the software on their computer and downloads the blockchain, they are part of the server on the network. Anybody can do it anywhere. If they shut you or your neighbor down, it doesn't affect any of the other millions of users anywhere in the world who use it. And so, you know, it's this. When I describe the blockchain, essentially the blockchain is a bunch of blocks of data that are chained together. And each person who uses Bitcoin, they download this blockchain in full, so they have record of the entire blockchain. And then whenever a transaction occurs, all of these computers, all of the millions of them on this network, essentially, you know, and mostly the miners, but they verify these transactions. And then everybody on the network stores this information. So, you know, a lot of people will say, well, it can be counterfeited. No, it can't be counterfeited. The only way that it would be counterfeited is if they did a successful 51% attack and then basically reversed the entire network, which would, I mean, it's possible, but it would take a huge amount of computing power to do it. And the Bitcoin network is the largest, fastest computer network in the world right now. And so, you know, there are all of these, you know, basic things that are a part of Bitcoin that make it a decentralized system. And, you know, people will say, well, you know, the government's going to tax it now. Well, yeah, they can tax it. But, you know, here's the thing is you have to volunteer the information. And, you know, the real thing with Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies is they're opt-in systems. Nobody is forcing you to use them. You choose to use them. And if they try to crash one, there's hundreds of others that you can switch to. You can diversify, you can hedge, you can do all of that stuff. For the first time in history, it basically gives the little guy the same power as all of these big bankers and Wall Street guys. But, you know, it gives all of us the power to do it. But at the same time, we can opt out of their centralized money system. And the more people that opt into Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, and take your pick, it doesn't matter. But it's your choice. That is what matters. But the more that opt out of the forced government money that they say, you have to use, the more that just stop using it, the more money that goes into Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies, the fewer people will be there to accept, for instance, Canadian and U.S. dollars. And eventually it's going to come to a point where the police and the military also don't want to accept those dollars. And when they no longer want to accept those dollars, then, these government boots from these people in these costumes is no longer going to be on people's throats. When you opt into a voluntary system, you realize, you know, part of understanding, my throat.
That's okay.
Part of understanding Bitcoin is really understanding that you can empower yourself. You can be in control of your own money. It's like, you know, a lot of people are turned off by this when you say it this way, but essentially you become your own banker. And people say, well, bankers are phony and they make their own money and all of this stuff. Well, it's not quite like that. Essentially, you know, you can send your money anywhere in the world to family members, anywhere, etc. And there's no one who can tell you that you can or can't. There's no company like Western Union who's going to charge you 30 or 40% if you send your money, for instance, down to Peru or something, right? And the poorer the country, the more they charge. And which is, you know, it's kind of the antithesis of how you think it should be. And so, you know, people who try to get work and send money back to their families just to send the money down, they get taxed like 40% of the money they're trying to send down. So Bitcoin enables them to send that money directly to the family member or to somebody in their neighborhood who has Bitcoin, and then they can do the cash transaction right there. And there are services that are already doing this. And so, you know, there are all of these workarounds that empower the people. You know, it's like if you want to move to another country, you know, the government wants to track all of your money. Well, you know, when you have Bitcoin, essentially all you're traveling with is a number, and you can memorize the number. And so, you know, they can't see any money traveling. There's, you know, the money is stored in the blockchain. It's not something that you carry physically on you. You memorize the long SHA-256 hash code that would get you to the money, but that's it. So anybody anywhere in the world who uses Bitcoin, they've downloaded this entire blockchain. And when you go to any place in the world, that same blockchain is the same one that anybody here has. And you put in that password and boom, there you have access to your money. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, what about the limits of spending it? Well, you know, if the more people, and of course, and new money, you know, starts out slow, especially one that's a voluntary system. People have to learn what it is and opt into it. You know, nobody's going to come to your door and say, you have to use the new Canadian dollar. You have to use the new U.S. dollar. You know, you have to decide. You have to educate yourself and decide to opt into it and say, yeah, you know, I see a benefit of me being in control of my own money and not having the banks reporting every transaction that I do and not having the credit cards having a record of every single thing that I've ever purchased. I mean, in the blockchain, you know, that information is stored there, but it's very difficult to go down and, you know, go track down every single number. And the interesting thing is you can create a new wallet number for every transaction you do as well. And so then, another thing with Bitcoin is how secure you are with it is also your own opt-in. You decide how secure you want to be with it. So you're the banker. It's your responsibility. If you get your stuff stolen, if you don't cover your security well and learn cryptography well, that's your choice. And, you know, you're probably only going to screw up once or twice before you shape up and start doing things a different way. And so, you know, again, it's all opt-in. It's, you know, it's your level of security. How much do you want? And, you know, but being a centralized thing, the more people that use a voluntary money, the less they're going to be, you know, IRS people and taxmen and whoever else to come and kick down your door and steal your money. Because you know what, they're not going to want that money either if more and more people continually opt out.
Sorry, could you say that last part again?
I said, you know, there's just going to be, you know, the more and more people that opt out, there's going to be fewer people to come kick in your door and force you to, you know, hand over your money, this centralized fiat government money, because eventually those people aren't going to want that money either.
Absolutely, and it's great to see a degradation of this system. It's been in an uphill battle for so long. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's just when you understand Bitcoin and these cryptocurrencies and how they work and some of the metacoins, etc., you see, you know, with a decentralized system, it's truly empowering for the people for the first time. It's not empowering for the bankers and for the, you know, people holding billions of the current money system. It's definitely not a great thing for them, but for the rest of us who want a chance and want a medium of exchange and want to be able to hedge money and diversify and do all of these things like the rich people do, and you know, not have the government sit there spying on every single thing that we do in our lives. You know, it's like, you know what? I'm an adult. I don't need the government. You know, my corporate personhood that they've created for me doesn't need, you know, they're dictating over my life. And so, you know, it's just, you know, it's basically the more people opt in and choose to use these things, the less suppression there's going to be, because the, you know, the less valuable the government fiat currencies are going to be simultaneously around the world to suppress people. You know, so it's essentially a defunding of government and centralized bank suppression around the world simultaneously. And then there's other things that come into play too, many other things like metacoins and things that can handle contracts and, you know, so that, you know, you start getting rid of the lawyers in that sense. Escrow can be handled through other coins and things like this. So, you know, there are many different aspects. And when people say, you know, these coins don't offer anything of value, that's untrue. Almost all of the coins, except for the copycat coins, but there's, you know, dozens of coins that actually do offer very original services. And Bitcoin itself is essentially just it's like TCP/IP for the internet. It's the protocol that everything runs on top of. It's not the internet itself. You know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when computers and were just being networked and things, you know, people didn't really get TCP/IP. Well, what are we going to do with this? And now we're streaming movies on top of it. We're listening to videos, having video conversations, downloading, sharing information, chat rooms, all of this stuff, and it happens on top of TCP/IP. And, you know, that's what gives you your address, essentially, on the internet. And that's essentially what, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain is it's a, it's just the protocol for all of this new decentralized stuff to run on. It's the rails for it to work on so that, you know, like the ICANN service, ICAAN, I think, that runs the, you know, the global services for the internet. When you type www.facebook.com, your browser actually sends the information to the ICANN government server, and it sends a signal back, oh, well, that computer is over at this IP address. And so this government server runs all of that information. Well, there's a coin called Namecoin that actually acts as the DNS server for a whole other internet called .bit. You know, so you can access all of these .bit websites through the Namecoin, and it's also called MeowBit, the application that it works with. But you know, this is a coin that's operated for a number of years, and it's there so that if they shut down the .com, .net websites and all of that stuff, we still have a decentralized workaround to be able to access .bit websites.
Well, that sounds like good news. And Jan, unfortunately, we're out of time now. But
all right.
It's been a fascinating discussion and very insightful. And I'm very honored to have had you as a guest again. Once.
Understood.
If you want to come back on in the future, you're welcome. I welcome it as well.
All right. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, before we leave, though, sure. I understand, just to give people some more information on this, is it true that you helped create CoinAlive.com?
Yeah, we run CoinAlive. My girlfriend Sarah runs CoinAlive.com. So if people want information on Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, we basically try to create a website where all of the core information that we've already studied and gone through, all of the best stuff, is sort of right there, so that people that want to go to that website and study it and get it all in one place, we've tried to pull it all together. We've talked about doing a show over there as well. And then, you know, my main website is GnosticMedia.com. That's where the podcast is. And that's GnosticMedia.com. Then I also run TriviumEducation.com. So if you want to get information for what your children are not taught in school, which they should be. And, you know, it's like when you look back in the 1890s and you see what the eighth graders' graduation tests were, and you compare them to the bachelor's degree exams today, you see that the eighth grade tests were harder in the 1890s than a four-year college education. So that was all based on the Trivium. And, you know, so we run TriviumEducation.com, TRIVIUM Education.com. And people can check that out. And, you know, the show is donation-based, like I think yours is. So please help to support Amir's show and help to support Gnostic Media as well. And we appreciate it.
Thanks for that. So, again, that was Jan Irvin from CoinAlive.com, GnosticMedia.com, TriviumEducation.com. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. I'm Amir Alwani from PotentNews.com. That's a wrap.